So in starting really in the 1930s, once the Federal Housing Administration was just created in the United States as a part of the New Deal, which would offer federally backed loans for people to buy homes, Black people usually couldn't take advantage of that. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of racist from the word go. And so you used to have these maps that would sort of say the green areas are good and the yellow areas might be a little problematic and the red areas are a no-go. And usually the red areas were poor people and Black people or other people of color. And when they were building the highway system here in the U.S., they basically said, well, fuck them, and decided to put some of these highway systems, especially in major cities, through the redlining district. It was a way of kind of knocking out two birds with one stone because they wanted to reinvigorate those parts of the cities and essentially displace the poor people, do what we would now call today gentrification.
Right. All right. Hi, and welcome to Red Reviews, the podcast where we talk about a variety of books from a Marxist and anarchist lens. I'm joined by Justin Clark. Thanks for joining me, Justin.
Hi, Corey. How's it going?
Not too bad.
I feel bad. I always jump in you. I feel bad about that. It's the lag. Yeah. I just need to wait. And then you don't want to have the awkward pause, too.
That's right. So that's right.
You know, what do you want? You know, what can you do? But anyway, yes, thank you, Corey. I'm excited to be here doing another episode of Red Reviews. I was just on the Left of the Projector podcast last night talking about Citizen Kane. Cool. So we will that episode will probably come out at some point, and, you know, did some good promotion of the show.
Nice.
So hopefully, you know, folks will check that out and come and check our stuff out, too. It's been a busy couple of weeks. Get towards the end of the year. We're already in November. This year went crazy fast.
Kidding.
I'm just excited to to be talking about this book tonight. I think that this book is going to be an excellent companion, or, as you know, Adam Johnson of the Citations Needed podcast calls it, a spiritual sequel to the episode that just dropped on the YouTube channel, which is all about how big tech is destroying art and creativity. Cory Doctorow and Rebecca Giblin's book, Chokepoint Capitalism. This book and this episode that we're going to be talking about is a wonderful companion to that episode. Tonight's book is Road to Nowhere. I think the subtitle is What Silicon Valley Gets Wrong About the Future of Transportation by Paris Marx.
Very cool.
I think it was published last year by Verso Books. Always good with the Verso. Verso's always killing it with their great books. Paris Marx is a journalist, is an author. He's the host of the Tech Won't Save Us podcast, which is a terrific podcast if people want to check that out. And that's kind of how I got to know him. I think mostly through you. Like, you had talked about it, and then I went and checked it out. I was like, oh, this is great. Or somebody did. I can't remember exactly when, but this
book listening to it for a long time now. So
I think it's terrific. And I think, like, I really feel like it breaks, I kind of mentioned in the pregame, like, most Silicon Valley discourse kind of breaks into two camps. You either have, like, sort of the cheerleaders for Silicon Valley, who tend to mostly be like Democrats and like liberals in the U.S. And people who hate big tech generally fall on the side of like Republicans. And it's mostly just because they like hate the YouTube, doesn't give them access to say like insanely like racist things or awful things. But what Paris Marx is doing, and much like Cory Doctorow and others, is really peeling back the curtain on the I think the problems of Silicon Valley. And so, as Cory Doctorow and Rebecca Giblin's book focused on art and music and film and television and its relation and how big tech is kind of ruining those aspects of our lives, this book is about how it ruins transportation. And I think that this book is a much broader conception of technology beyond just Silicon Valley, but it relates to Silicon Valley a lot. But I think the big thing is that I really love this book. I read it very, very quickly. It was a blast to read. It's very well written. It's very clear, concise, and has some really genuinely good insights. And I know you've been reading it too, and you've liked it quite a bit, right?
Yeah. I'm about 43% or something into it. Yeah, no, I really enjoy it. Like you say, like, I find that Paris Marx has a really good way of turning a phrase so that it really rolls. Like, you can read it casually and actually absorb it. So it's,
I think so. Yeah, I agree. And it's, you know, I think he's very clear about the challenges that we face. So, you know, in the early 21st century, you know, in the early 2020s, as we are in now, I think that, you know, humanity in some respects is at a crossroads. You know, we've been in the Industrial Revolution, the sort of liberal capitalist model now for 3-4 centuries. And it's led to, I think, some serious consequences.
Yeah.
One is the degradation of work and people's, you know, becoming increasingly more alienated from their work, where work is becoming more degrading, especially even in parts of the world you wouldn't think it would, like the United States or Canada. But simultaneously, we also face a climate crisis, which might be the biggest one of all, right? That the choices that we've made as societies have led us to, you know, potentially the end of life on Earth as we know it. And yeah. I think that all of that goes through this book, because, you know, and he's not the only person who's made this point, but he makes it very, very well, which is that, you know, there was a choice that was made about 100 years ago of instead of having societies built for people, they were built for cars.
Yep.
And the consequences of that are enormous. So, you know, I'm a huge fan of a great YouTube channel called Not Just Bikes, which is a great YouTube channel of a guy who was from Canada. I think he was from, I forget exactly where he was from. Might have been London, Ontario. But anyway, he was from Canada, hated it, and said, okay, this sucks. Like, living here sucks because there's no sidewalks. It's all about cars. It's polluted. It's gross. Where can I go? And he moved to the Netherlands. He moved his whole family to the Netherlands because it's a country that decided about 50 years ago, you know, sort of halfway through the life cycle of the car oriented world that we live in. They said, nah, this doesn't work. This isn't working. And they actively tried to reshape society around pedestrians, communities, and bikes and all of that. Great channel that's gotten me got me into this world. And another book I recommend people check out that's related to these issues is a book called Strong Towns. Okay. It's not explicitly, I think it's by, like, I think his name's Chuck Mahone, or I think it's like Chuck Marone is the name, Charles Marone. Okay. He was a city planner for decades, and wrote a book about, like, the problems with building societies around cars. Because that is, I think, a through line through this book, Paris Marx's book, is the problem of building societies around everyone having individualized transport.
Yep.
Right. But the Strong Towns book is a great book about the problems with building it that way. I don't always agree with some of its solutions. It's kind of sort of normie centrist stuff, but the diagnosis of the problem, I think, is pretty good. So, you know, I think in general, this book talks a lot about the promise of Silicon Valley and the reality of what Silicon Valley gave us.
Right.
So, you know, post 2008, after the economy fell into a ditch and the political class had to kind of figure out how to pick up the pieces and what was going to be the next thing that was going to make people feel comfortable about continuing on the system within capitalism. And they sort of threw all their chips in on Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And there's sort of the California ideology. And it's something that Paris Marx talks about in the book. He also talks about in his podcast with other people. The Californian ideology is this kind of weird mix of, like, messianism. So it's like about, you know, the savior that will come and save us. And instead of it being Jesus, it's technology.
Right.
There's the libertarianism element of it, where it's, you know, you can't trust governments. Governments are crap. So that you have to leave it to the market. So it comes out of the sort of 60s counterculture, you know, and it's kind of the classic thing where people say about the sort of the 60s radicals. It's like, well, we can't change the, so in the 60s, they're like, let's change the world.
Yeah.
And then they get to the 70s, say, well, we can't really change the world, so let's change ourselves. Let's make ourselves better. But by the 80s, that didn't really work either. So they're like, well, we can't change the world and we can't really change ourselves, so let's just make money.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much where it went to. And that weird mix of sort of religious messianism and libertarianism is embodied in somebody like Kevin Kelly, who founded Wired Magazine, mm-hmm. who is both a technological evangelist and a fundamentalist Christian. So he's a very interesting, like very weird mix. And he's, you know, his influence on this and other people, obviously people like Stuart Brand of the Whole Earth Catalog or John Perry Barlow, who founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Like all of these guys were very involved in developing the ideology of Silicon Valley, which was that in order to solve our problems, we do not need politics. We just need better technology to solve our problems.
Right.
And that is, I think it's a huge problem. Yeah. I think it's one that Paris Marx really hits on in this book.
Yeah. It's like a non-ideology of an ideology, but in that way, it also leaves like so much on the table. So much unexamined and so much undealt with in the name of like enlightened fucking technological advancement and like, it's just, I don't know. It's like, it reminds me of like the Chicago School free market mentality, yeah. Right? Like,
absolutely. I think that there was, you know, I think that like we always make the argument, you know, I've always sort of thought of it this way. And I think others have too, that like, you know, the people who claim that they're non-ideological are the most ideological.
Yeah.
In the sense that they're not clear or open about what cards they're putting on the table. They're just not, you know? And I think that sort of non-ideology or third way politics or the radical center or the extreme center, as Tariq Ali calls it, is extremely dangerous because it's an enemy that is very squishy. It's one that you can't really put a finger on and say like, here's the problem. It's not like fascism. It's not like, you know, it's not like some specific political ideology that you can go, that's a problem. Here's why it's a problem. Here's how we combat that. But the neoliberal model is very, very squishy and moves around because it says it's non-ideological.
Yeah.
That it's sort of, we're not going to be addressing fundamental questions. We're just going to be trying to do tweaks that will fix things, hopefully.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that's disastrous. And it really reinforces that that, you know, governments don't work, or the better yet, that civil society doesn't work, right? Because you know, you have government and you have the market, and sort of in between those two things is civil society. You know, these are the, you know, right. These are your political and social organizations that kind of help society run. You know, churches kind of fall in this group, NGOs kind of fall in this group, but civil society matters. And Silicon Valley just says, nope, you know, government is not important and civil society is not important and community interests are not important. The only thing that matters is the market and technology. That if we leave things up to merely what we can do instrumentally and what can we do in a market-oriented fashion, everything will be fine. And I think what people have realized, and it took very little time for us to get there in terms of like, peer, like, you know, because there was the Silicon Valley sort of everybody rah-rah about 10 years ago. That's all dead. Like no one, right. I mean, most mainstream don't think that way anymore. I think they're much more critical of Silicon Valley because it has been the absolute king of overpromising and under-delivering, you know, which is what we'll talk about a little bit tonight with Musk and Elon. So let's kind of set up the groundwork for what's coming later in the episode. So the first chapter is called How the Automobile Disrupted Mobility. Mm-hmm. This is a great chapter where Paris Marx goes all the way back to the beginning of the automobile and kind of lays out how did the automobile develop as a cultural and economic product that then shifted culture and government and civil society.
Yeah.
So, you know, about 125 years ago, you know, if you went to, you know, downtown, you know, Indianapolis in 1900, most of what you would see on the road would not be cars.
Right.
You would see mostly people, horse-drawn carriages, bicycles, any kind of, you know, and then streetcars,
right,
trains. Those are the things that you would see. And a little over 100 years ago, you know, anybody could use the streets. So you could walk wherever you kind of wanted to. There were no like crosswalks. There were no stoplights. It was just people got to where they needed to go.
Right.
And children could play in the street. You know, most people didn't go faster than 10 miles an hour. It was not, other than maybe the streetcars, which were faster. But it was very clear where those streetcars were, because there were track lines where those streetcars would
be. Right.
And a lot of times they were also electrified. So there was electric wiring that would go down the street. So you knew where they were. And that's not to say that this was like paradise, because it wasn't.
Right.
It was still dangerous specifically. And it was very like unsanitary, because like, you know, a lot of roads were just dirt or gravel. Sometimes with hay, you would have, you know, horse manure all over the place. You'd have human refuse all over the place.
Yeah.
It was not to say that like this was great, but there was a certain communitarian ethic behind the roads. Everybody could kind of use them and everybody could kind of share them based on some shared norms.
Yeah.
This all gets disrupted by the automobile. And, you know, automobiles, when they were originally developed, were a luxury product. They were something that only rich people owned. And Paris Marx sort of makes the argument that maybe that's how they should have stayed. because when you take something which is inherently a luxury, and his thinking is very influenced by the theorist André Gorz, who he cites a lot in the book, about the idea of luxury turning into a mass commodity and the sort of ecological and economic consequences of that.
Right.
Because automobiles were, you know, cars were very much a luxury product. Most people didn't own them. And especially pre-assembly line, Ford's assembly line and the development of the Model T. And more broadly, what Marxian economics often calls Fordism, the idea of developing assembly line economic systems, which then sort of streamline and systematize other aspects of capital. And with the development of the automobile, there were no speed limits. There were no clear lines of how you drove in these things. So one of the first things that you notice is that people died a lot.
Yeah.
And specifically children. And so, you know, with the development of the car and the car becoming more and more of a thing that people owned, the roads became more and more dangerous, because the whole thing about cars was speed. You got speed, and people wanted to go as fast as they wanted to, and there were no limits on that. You know, the first speed limits are sort of introduced sometime in the 1920s and 30s, and largely it's because of public pressure. You know, you have these campaigns where of organizations, a lot of times they were women's groups who would lead, you know, look how many kids have died, how many kids have died in this specific community or died on the street. We need some kind of action. At the same time that you see the rise of the automobile, you see the decline of public transit. And so, you know, I grew up in my teens and in my 20s as a young person. I lived in Howard County, Indiana, which is about an hour north of the center of the state in Indianapolis. And this is city, Kokomo, Greentown, you know. And, you know, Greentown, not a huge city, but not even really a town, it had a Carnegie Library and had some businesses, but it had an interurban line. And interurbans were the streetcar systems that were, you know, developed, and they were mostly private. I mean, most of them were private businesses, but they were sort of run by public utilities, where they were heavily regulated by city and local governments to ensure that prices were fair and safety was paramount. So like it's very much like, you know, people who have public utilities today, where it's probably a private firm, but it's heavily regulated. So it's very much like this sort of, you know, in neoliberal language, it's what we call a public-private partnership. And the thing at the time was that the streetcars were very heavily regulated, but the cars were not. individual mm-hmm. automobiles weren't. And this led to some serious pressures where the, especially once you have the development of the Model T, you know, the first mass produced assembly line, you know, created automobile by Henry right. Ford. The goal was to get it to a place where the people making them could buy them. Because up until the Model T, most cars, the people who made them could not afford them.
Yeah.
Or if they could, they could barely afford them. The Model T changed all that. And then in the 20s or the 30s introduces the Model A, which makes things even more streamlined. And one of the things you see automatically right away is that the streetcars cannot compete with the automobile. They just can't. And so they start going away. Now, is it all based on economic pressures? No.
Of course not.
Some of it was by design. So this is my point of the episode where I say, thinking about everything as a conspiracy theory is not good, but some conspiracy theories are true. And there is one. So, you know, what happened, especially in the 20s and the 30s, was the oil industries and the automobile industries bought up all the streetcar companies and stopped them. They ripped the tracks out of the ground. They took the cars, the streetcars off the roads. And a lot of small towns that had interurban, where most people got around either by walking, bicycling, horse-drawn carriages or streetcars, by practically almost within a matter of 30 years, that completely goes away.
Yeah.
And roads become not areas where the community shared them to only really, they're only for cars. And this is where you see America, especially in the United States, but it's also in other parts of the world, especially Western Europe and Canada, that start designing cities and their countries, not around human beings, but around the car.
Yeah.
And it leads to disastrous consequences because, everyone having an individualized vehicle is extremely inefficient. Some of our listeners may have seen those memes that I think are, or graphics that I think are very telling, where it's imagine people on a road in cars, but the cars aren't there. So you see all these people, individual people, very far apart sitting in the road. Yeah. And then you see like them on like a bus. And there's more of them that you can get on a bus. And then on a train, it's like the best, or like subways or streetcars, it's like the best. And so it's deeply inefficient, which has led, I think, to various problems, whether in Los Angeles, which was kind of the car capital of the world in mid 20th century, the problem of smog.
Yeah,
literally could not see the fucking sky because of cars. So you had that. Then you also had, obviously, the problem of lead in gasoline, which is something he doesn't bring up necessarily in the book, but I think is relevant, which is that gasoline basically up until like the 1960s and 70s had lead in it. And so everybody was breathing that in.
Yeah.
And lead leads to neurological problems. It's very dangerous. That's why like people say, why do they call gas unleaded these days? It's that for that
because
reason.
It has no lead in it. Because it used to have lead. No lead in it.
Because it used to have lead in it.
Yeah.
There was also, you know, and so this is how we get to the society where everybody pretty much in most countries, unless you're maybe in like Western Europe, but if you're in the industrialized world, most people have to have cars. There's no other way to get around.
Yeah.
And we've designed whole societies around cars where homes are built completely separate from the other parts of the town. In the United States, there are zoning laws where like if it's residential, you can't have a business.
Right.
And if it's commercial area, a commercial zoned, you can't have a residence there. That's starting to change, but like very slowly.
What a terrible, terrible way to design cities.
Terrible. But you have to think about like, I agree with you 100%, but I think about it specifically this way. As the American economy post-World War II moved to an economy of production to an economy of consumption. Mm-hmm. The automobile was an essential component of that.
Right.
So in order to have those suburban homes, to have the shopping malls, to have the auto manufacturing, you know, which for a lot of time were good union jobs that people could have a middle class income
yep.
on one job. all of those were a way of being able to basically supercharge the economy. Now, it could have been very different. The world could have been very different, but that was the choice that was made.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just, and so you had federal policy in the United States that literally set up the interstate systems and used, essentially pushed poor and black people out of neighborhoods in order to build them.
Yeah.
So people might be familiar with redlining. So starting really in the 1930s, once the Federal Housing Administration was just created in the United States as a part of the New Deal, which would offer federally backed loans for people to buy homes, black people usually couldn't take advantage of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of racist from the word go. And so used to have these maps that would sort of say the green areas are good and the yellow areas might be a little problematic and the red areas are a no-go. And usually the red areas were poor people and black people or other people of color. And when they were building the highway system here in the U.S., they basically said, well, fuck them, and decided to put most of these, some of these highway systems, especially in major cities, through the redlining district. It was a way of kind of knocking out two birds with one stone because they wanted to reinvigorate those parts of the cities and essentially displace the poor people, do what we would now call today gentrification.
Right.
And so with all of that, we've built this hyper-highwayed individualized transport that, you know, it's taking a luxury product and making it a mass consumption product, and it's had disastrous consequences as a result. And that is not even getting us to Silicon Valley yet. But that's like, right. But that's really, this is the setup, because Paris Marx's solutions in the last chapter are very relevant, because the way that we get out of this crisis is going to be moving away from car-centric cities and societies.
Right.
It's really the way to go. So we've talked about the Silicon Valley worldview. We've talked about how the automobile kind of developed. Let's talk about specific technologies. So electric vehicles. We are sold on the idea that electric vehicles will be the thing that'll get us out of this.
Right.
You know, that we can sort of, and electric vehicles are kind of the ultimate example of having your cake and eating it too.
Right.
Because
get to have cars.
You still get to have cars and individualized transport.
Yeah.
But you are also sort of solving the climate change problem because you're no longer filling a gas tank.
Yeah. Now we get to pretend that there's no more problem with what we're doing.
Now, one of the really interesting aspects of the book is that people don't realize that electric cars go all the way back to the beginning. So there were electric cars 100 years ago that worked. But due to a mixture, I think I very much compare it to Beta and VHS. You know, so I'm a child of the 90s.
Yep.
And, you know, and you're kind of a child of the 80s, 90s. And so you know the difference between, so in the 1980s and 70s, there was a huge, like, there was a very huge conflict between two media formats. There was VHS and there was Beta. Now, Beta, by all accounts, was basically better.
Yeah, it was actually picture quality, way better.
It was way better. Better picture quality, better sound quality, everything. But VHS was cheaper and it had more operability. So like Betamax tapes can only cover like an hour. You could tape up to like 4 8-hours on a VHS tape. Might look like shit, but you can get 8 hours on a tape.
Yeah.
And so even though objectively Beta was better, VHS won the war and Beta died. And VHS became kind of the standard. It's the same thing with cars. You had electric cars and you had gasoline powered cars. At the time, you know, electric cars could have been the option, but they weren't, primarily because gas and oil was so freely available and cheap.
Yeah.
Nobody cared. It ultimately won out because it was a lot more sort of in the short term economically viable to have gasoline powered automobiles than it was to have electric ones.
Yep.
So that's why it went that way. So, you know, and then people forget that, you know, that GM was actually working on an electric car in the 90s. It was called the EV1, which he covers in the book. There's a great documentary that he mentions. I think it's called Whatever Happened to the Electric Car or something like that. What Killed the Electric Car? Because they had developed an electric car. Yeah, Who Killed the Electric Car? And, you know, that the EV1, which, by the way, you can actually see there's a prototype model of EV1 at the Smithsonian Museum of American History. So you can go see it, you know, and it looks kind of like a regular old car. But yeah, when you realize that it was an electric car, it was made 25 years ago, you kind of go, wait a minute. But again, why didn't that really go off? You know, why were people looking into electric cars in the first place? Well, that goes back to the 1970s. So, and this is going to sound familiar to people. In the 1970s, there was something, there was another major war, I think it might have been Israel and Lebanon, and in the early 70s, and the United States backed Israel. This pissed off OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, and they said, oh, so you want to back Israel, huh? We're cutting you off. And so all of this cheap gasoline and oil that was coming out of the Middle East started to get very, very, very expensive and hard to get. Because domestic oil production had basically plummeted by the time you get into the 1970s. So there's an oil crisis. So people are moving more to fuel-efficient cars. So the idea of an electric car kind of becomes a thing again. So in the 1990s, by the time the EV1 comes around, it's a viable product. It's something that GM could make and could mass produce, and people could afford to buy. The big issue was, at the time, this is the 90s. This is the big go 90s, where the crisis of the 70s was gone. And so oil and gas was dirt cheap again. And so people said, fuck it. Let's keep going with cars. And so this is the era where instead of people buying fuel efficient cars like they did in like the 70s, people are buying SUVs and trucks, and cars keep getting bigger, bigger, and bigger, and bigger. So the point now where I live here in Indiana, trucks almost look like tanks.
Yeah.
So much so that they're often becoming hard for even agricultural, like for farmers to use. There's been a story recently about folks have been importing Japanese trucks to do farm work because they're so much better at it than these big hulking trucks that we make in the U.S. So long story short, we could have had an electric car 25, 30 years ago, and we didn't. Now we're getting back into the 2020s, where in 2010s and 2020s, where climate change is a serious issue and people are starting to take it more seriously. But they do not want to change the broader strokes of society.
Right.
They want to tweak around the edges. And there's a really good point that kind of goes through this book that Paris Marx makes, which is Silicon Valley solutions to problems often come from the narcissism of the tech, sort of the tech innovators themselves, that they think that their specific problems and their solutions to their specific problems that may only really work for them, work for everybody. Yeah. And they really don't. And the electric vehicle, as it currently stands, is one of those.
Right.
So with all of that in mind, we're half hour in. Let's talk about Elon Musk. this is my pivot to, I'm going to start really ripping into Musk. So Tesla. And Tesla, again, I want people to know, Elon Musk did not found Tesla. He may call himself the founder of Tesla, but he did not. Tesla was founded by two other individuals. Elon Musk bought them out and bought the title of founder.
Yep.
So we're already off. We're already starting with a lie.
Yep.
We're already starting with nonsense. So the way that the Teslas have been sold, and the idea of Teslas, and the idea of electrical vehicles or hybrid vehicles in general, is that this is how we can maintain our go-go production and the consumerist society that we have, and this individualized consumer society, while alleviating the problems of climate change. But as anyone knows, who has either read this book or has read about electric cars in general, if anything, the burdens, the environmental impacts of the electric cars are not less, they're just shifted.
Yep.
And they're shifted in different ways. So one of the ways is all the batteries and all of the components of electric vehicles often require very specific rare earth metals and minerals and elements that go into them, like cobalt.
Yep.
In order to get those, or lithium for the batteries, or cobalt, all these, you know, harder minerals. Some of these are deeply toxic in the wild, in the raw form. The other problem with it too is that a lot of them are often done literally by slave labor or child labor. There's serious, documented, we know this happens for sure. These are often in areas of the global south who have a disproportionate economic balance between them and industrialized countries. This is where we get the line where Elon Musk said, we'll coup anyone we want, talking about Venezuela, because Venezuela had, or not Venezuela, Bolivia. Yeah, Bolivia has a very substantial amount of lithium deposits. Yeah. And so the thing is that electric batteries for cars are very, very toxic. They're very toxic. And the thing about cars, as they're constituted right now, they suck, but the difference is it's kind of dispersed in the atmosphere. Like you with you know, hydrocarbon powered cars, you put it in, it lets out emissions, and that's it. Whereas with electric vehicles, those batteries are kind of around forever, and they often have very toxic components to them that we have not really figured out a consensus on how to either properly waste dispose of them,
right?
Properly dispose of them as waste, or to recycle them, because we don't really have that either. There's no global consensus on this. So this is where the electric vehicle really isn't better for the environment. It's just shifting the burdens in another way. The other part of it that's a problem too is that the electric vehicles, especially the ones made by Tesla, are often made rather poorly. So, you know, the big three, you know, Chrysler, GM, and Ford, say whatever you want about them, they can make a car.
Right.
And the Japanese with Toyota, they can definitely make a car. You know, there are like 93 Honda Civics that are still on the road today. You know, they have so many miles on them, the odometer went back to zero. Like, they still run because they're that well made. Teslas are not well made. They're very pretty. They look nice, but they're not very well made at all.
Right.
And we have reports of constant labor abuses at the factory. They're not unionized, so you have that problem too. They don't have sort of interoperable parts. They have very specific components that are a lot harder to change out.
Although,
the servicing,
I heard that now they're either Tesla was forced to, or somebody was forced to, so they can all charge on the same fucking plugs now.
Yeah. It's like the phones. It's like the same thing with the phones, where Apple's going to move to having a USB-C port on their phones, not because they really wanted to have it to be interoperable, but because it was going to be too expensive for them to have USB-C ports in Europe, which requires all ports to be USB-Cs by law, and everywhere else to be something else. They said, to hell with it, we'll just have them all be the same, which tells you they could have done that from the beginning. But and the other thing I think that's a huge problem is that the way that electric vehicle production and consumption is currently constituted, at least in the United States, is it's an upward shifting of wealth from poor people to rich people.
Yeah.
So if you look at the people who often buy Teslas, or you know, generation before would have bought hybrids, you know, they would have bought a Prius, they're getting massive subsidies from the federal government to buy them, which means that taxpayers are subsidizing for upper middle class and rich people to buy fancy cars. That's crap.
Yeah.
Like, that's all money that we could have put into public transit, better fuel efficiency standards, better... You know, federal grants to create communities that didn't require as much, you know, car infrastructure. Those are all the benefits of that would have been much more dispersed.
Yeah.
So that's the issue too, is that the way that these technologies have been developed, they often shift the wealth, as capitalism often does, from everybody up to the very, very small amount of the rich or the really upper middle class. The thing is that the only people who could buy these kinds of cars are people who are wealthy or upper middle class to begin with. They have the resources. They could buy it outright or with a loan if they wanted to.
Yeah.
But they're the ones getting those subsidies. It's a way, and That's the other thing too, but I think just in a general point about Musk that kind of goes beyond the scope of this book, but I think is relevant, which is that that guy's whole empire is built on this. It's all built on federal money. It's all built on grants and federal contracts, whether it's SpaceX or Solar City or whatever. And so, yeah, like the electric car is not going to be the solution to the problem. No. It's going to be a part of it. I mean, I think moving to a more electric car future would be good.
Sure.
But we have to figure out certain problems with it, like not having children pull toxic metals out of the ground and having better labor standards and having better, and honestly, having it so that like we're not subsidizing people buying them.
Yeah,
that they're just made cheaper to begin with.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, because we shouldn't have I don't like the idea of the federal government using its money, which could be better spent helping poor and working class communities, to subsidize some rich asshole to get a Tesla. I just don't like that at all.
And like part of me is always like thinking we could probably be getting the cobalt or the lithium through like legitimate, like actually paying for it properly ways. If it wasn't built by the profit motive of these fucking Silicon Valley companies like Tesla, like if Elon Musk doesn't need to be a billionaire or have, you know, the company doesn't have to have billions in profits when if it paid people properly and paid for things properly.
Yes, that's right. And the other thing too is that like Tesla as a company is way overvalued too.
Right.
Like it makes a fraction of a fraction of the auto fleet in the United States or globally.
Yeah.
And yet it's like worth more than the big three combined. Like it's kind of absurd.
Makes no sense,
like
actually.
It makes absolutely no sense. It's just sort of it's euphoria based on nothing. So, you know, so that's so like the electric car is really not going to solve our problems. It's just not. The better way to use resources. I mean, we could also like do things differently with like electric cars in terms of not giving people subsidies who don't need them and better labor standards.
Yeah. But
the better thing is instead of putting all of our resources and our energies towards that, we put it towards building high speed rails, rail systems, subway systems, and electric buses, like mass transit that can get people around. That would be a much better use of resources because as he points out in the book, like in order for everybody to have like individualized cars, like the demand for all of these rare earth elements
huge.
Or metals, it's going to be huge and the prices are going to go through the floor and it's going to lead to widespread environmental degradation, not just greenhouse gases, but we're seeing loss of biodiversity, loss of ecosystems.
Yeah.
That's the other issue too. So like, you know, if you see some like, I don't know, like motherfucker driving a Tesla, like in some respects, that car might have a much longer carbon footprint per year than a gasoline powered car would.
Yeah.
Because they do. They just do. And so that's the issue, too. But yeah,
I guess we got a couple comments.
Let's go to the comments. Yeah.
Some random geek said, the way to reduce our carbon footprint is to shift city planning and transportation to offer a lot more public transit and get rid of car culture.
Yeah, that's right. It's the half earth idea. People often misconstrue what the half earth idea is, but it's a good one. So the half earth idea comes from a biologist named Geo Wilson. And his whole idea is that humans should really only live on about half the planet.
Right.
Now, he's not arguing for like eugenics or anything like that.
Right.
What he's arguing for is shifting our communities away from being so sprawled out to having more high density cities so that we can leave more of the earth to just be the earth rather than being for us.
Yeah.
I think half earth is a good idea and half earth cities. I think somebody wrote a book called Half Earth Cities or something like
that.
I first learned about this idea through Kim Stanley Robinson, you know, going all the way back to the very beginning of this podcast where we talked about Ministry for the Future. But yeah, I totally agree with some random geek. You know, it's about mass transit, building communities where people can live and work and play in areas where it's densely populated, but also gives people that sense of community, gives them that sense of privacy too, that they can have their own lives. They don't have to, I'm not asking people to eat in like the people's commissar. I'm just saying like, although that wouldn't be bad.
I am, actually.
I'm not opposed to it, you know.
That kind of idea, like that goes all the way back to like Socrates and Plato, like that idea of a communal eating area and how that builds community for people. And
And we talked a little bit about it when we talked about Bertrand Russell's book about his idea of city planning, where you could build, you know, public buildings that were owned by the people, where people could have meals all together and I think that's fine. Like, I'm all for more rather than less in terms of how people want to live their lives. But I think people have this conception that building these heavy dense cities would be heavy dense cities as they are constituted currently under capitalism.
Right. Right.
Which is a level of hell, right?
Yeah, like that's true.
You know, you're basically giving off your first children, your firstborn to basically have a small ass apartment. Like it's not equitable. So like we would build that better future in an equitable way.
Yeah, that's right. And some random geek also said, Elon Musk thinks he's Tony Stark and Steve Jobs, but he's just a worse Steve Jobs. And at least Steve Jobs knows what people want.
That's true. So Walter Isaacson just recently put out a book about Musk. I might read it just because I'm curious, but I read his book on Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs, like, whatever you want to say about him, I mean, he sucked in a lot of ways. I mean, just look up, I mean, I would look up videos of him driving in like Cupertino without a license plate. So what he would often do is for a certain amount of days, you didn't have to have a license plate to sit in the state of California. So he would lease vehicles or rent out vehicles and have them for just enough time so that he didn't have to have a license plate so that he could basically speed and park in handicapped parking spaces and do whatever the fuck he wanted to.
just to be a prick.
To be a prick. And there are people who've literally caught him on video, like, or pictures of him parking in parking spaces that are like handicapped parking spaces or speeding around people in California. He was also in some respects full of shit too. Like Walter Isaacson talks about in his book about how Jobs he would often sort of fall back to what he called the reality distortion field, mm-hmm. which basically that Steve Jobs was a good bullshitter, not just to other people, but to himself.
Right.
The difference is, I think, between him and Musk is that when Steve Jobs often promised things, his company would deliver on them. So like when he introduced the iPhone worked and people bought it and it actually made money.
Right.
Whereas like when Elon Musk introduces the Cybertruck and this dystopian nightmare straight out of like a Paul Verhoeven movie, like straight out of RoboCop. And it's like, oh, it's indestructible. And then someone throws a ball at it and a baseball, I think. And the fucking thing breaks. Also, Paris Marks Gates makes a good point in the book about the Cybertruck where he mentions like only Elon would really want that because he's the only one worried about having a vehicle that bullets can't penetrate. Right. Most people don't think about is my vehicle bulletproof? Yeah, and it's like, maybe you should have a little more reflection on yourself if you think that you need a bulletproof vehicle.
Yeah, that's right.
Just maybe a little more self-reflection. So
I don't know if it was in the book. It must not have been, but or maybe it was later. But on his podcast, so the last four episodes or the previous four episodes were about Elon Musk, mm-hmm. and he really talks about the whole. I think it was the boring tunnel or whatever it was, and how this whole thing was actually just Elon Musk wanted a faster way to drive to and from a place, so he was like, this is my plan, and it worked for him, but it doesn't work for any other fucking person.
Exactly. So yes, this is in the book. So there's a chapter he has, I think it's called Making New Roads for Cars. And the chapter, we can pivot into talking about that.
Sure.
So Hyperloop, right?
Right, right.
So Elon Musk's whole vision of the Hyperloop, which is basically him reinventing the fucking subway and thinking he's a genius.
Yeah.
Years ago, he the big thing that Elon Musk always says, it's like cars are 2D. Everything is 2D. What I'm doing is 3D. And it's like, first off.
No, that's not subways, what that means.
That's not what that means. Like, first off, subways exist, which means we've always been playing transportation 3D.
Yeah. Even the way point, he thinks it means.
The other point is one that I heard years ago in Adam Conover's podcast when he talked to a city planner in Los Angeles, who also thought that Elon saying that was really dumb. And she said, does he not know about like highway ramps and like right. the way that the interstate system works? And you have
overpasses,
all and overpasses and bridges. It's like, we've been doing 3D shit forever. Like, yeah. you know, so he's an idiot. I mean, I think it's very important. I'm just going to say this right out the gate. Elon Musk is a moron. He's a moron. He got lucky once.
Stupid person.
He got lucky once with PayPal, and it's funded his idiocy ever since. Now, mind you, obviously, we have the whole, you know, apartheid, Clyde, the Emerald Mine, and all that.
Yes.
So it's not like he came from nothing, because he didn't, right?
Yeah.
But he got lucky once with PayPal, and that's where he made his nut, and has been doing insane bullshit ever since.
Yeah.
So the Boring Company, which is also a very funny name, but it's. So his whole idea was the Hyperloop, where he would build all of these elaborate tunnel systems underground for people to have transit. And originally right. he conceived of them as being like these cars that would have platforms that would be up on the street, and then they would go down into the street, and they would go inside the ground and then up and down. You'd have few people in it. And then people started to point out like the basic logistical issues with doing that, that like yeah. if you have cars up top, and these big cars that keep going up and down, it's going to fuck traffic up, because you'd have to have one lane just dedicated to the platforms.
Yeah.
The other thing too, is you'd have to design platforms that could still be driven over.
Right.
So like, how would you make them strong? Cause like they could collapse. I mean, and so over time, his like bigger vision got whittled down to the point where all it basically is a little tunnel in Las Vegas that people can drive Teslas in. yeah. And that's it.
Yeah, that's right.
So he they can't go fast. There's nothing hyper about it. He invented
the tunnel.
He invented the tunnel. He made a shittier version of the subway.
Yeah.
Subway trains or high-speed rail trains can go pretty fast, you know? A lot of subway cars can end up, you know, going 45, 50, 55 miles an hour underground.
Right.
I love taking mass transit wherever I go. I was just in DC a couple months ago, and I rode the metro and rode the bus the whole time I was there and loved it. It's a great way of getting around, and it's dirt cheap.
Yeah.
It costs almost nothing to go from Capitol Hill all the way to Reagan International Airport. It's $4. It's like $3.75.
Awesome. Yeah.
To do awesome. If you were to do an Uber of that, it's like $60.
Right.
it's literally pennies on the dollar. When my wife and I vacationed earlier this year in Seattle, we took their transit from downtown Seattle to SeaTac, which is Seattle Tacoma Airport. Same situation. I think we paid $3-$4, maybe $5 per ticket. And again, we had gone a few days before, we had taken a cab, because I don't do Ubers. Fuck Uber. I will always go in a cab. And the nice thing about always wanting to go in a cab is they're always there.
Right.
Because everybody's usually using the Uber or Lyft, and fuck that, because fuck Uber. And we'll get into that in a second.
Yeah.
But it's very cheap. So like this, I mean, it's like, I cannot believe that anybody who's like a thinking adult would ever think that his ideas were worth anything.
Yeah.
It's all hype. It's all just like, It's a brain worm. It's like people just buy into it, and it's so silly to me.
Yeah, it's by and large a product of the myth making of the media that at the time he was becoming popular when they were like really like the mainstream media was like all over tech, right? Like they were all like you say, like groupies for fucking tech.
Mm-hmm. And it was basically a reaction to the recession. It was capitalism had to sort of reorient itself and figure out, okay, what's the next big thing that will get people continually invested in the system?
Yeah.
Because at the time, especially in the post-recession era, you know, 9, 10, 11, you had the Occupy movement to a greater or lesser extent. You had the Tea Party movement. You had this big reaction against established wealth and privilege. I think in Occupy's case, I think it was a lot more genuine.
Yeah.
And so the Obama administration was very pro-tech and sort of pushed that as like the future. This is our future. And Musk was a part of that. So it was a media thing, right? The same people who propped up Elon Musk are the same people who propped up Elizabeth Holmes.
Right.
And her massive, even though her thing
physically was impossible,
It would literally, it defied not only the laws of physics, but it defied the laws of chemistry.
Yeah. It simply could not exist.
But. And they could, and the thing that's crazy is there's a great documentary about Theranos that Alex Gibney made, where one of her professors, I think maybe her physics or chemistry professors at Stanford before she dropped out, was a woman. And she was like, this does not work. Like, I cannot sign into this. This literally defies the laws of physics. This does not work. No one ever talked to this person.
Right.
No one. Anytime she got the big profile in Fortune, she got the big profile in everything. They never, ever got a second opinion. And you think
absurd.
And it's, and again, you'd think that these media would learn from their mistakes, but they don't, because they did the same thing with Musk and they did the same thing with Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX.
Yep.
Same damn thing. And as I said in the pregame, there's a very good shot Sam Bankman-Fried's going to be going to prison for the rest of his life.
Yep.
For basically orchestrating a massive Ponzi scheme.
Yep.
Which is what it was. Yep. And so, you know, is Musk as corrupt as them? Yes. It's just, I think he's been a lot better at sort of weathering the storms of it. And a lot of that is the media covering for him.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they want to prop up these guys because they want people to feel good about capitalism. Because it's clearly not fucking working for the vast majority of people.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's, they have to push it in some way. So all of this hype and all of this public money and all of these public subsidies and this, you know, the other thing is, and as you said earlier, it was all because he just wanted to have a better place to go from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And the other reason he wanted to do it was to kill the high-speed rail program. Oh,
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Which is the other thing.
Yeah.
And this gets us into like a bigger theme of the book, which is that a lot of these technologies technically really don't work or they don't generate a profit, but they do something much bigger and better, which is killing industries, specifically industries that have strong labor protections or union protections.
Yeah.
So that's like Uber. Like Uber is a good example of this. Uber, you know, the rideshare app has never generated a profit.
No.
And again, I'm going to say that again. It has never generated a profit. Why would anybody want to invest in it? It's because of the long-term goal, which is that it's killing the cab industry. It's making it much, much harder for people to have steady employment. So Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, all these companies, they sell themselves as, oh, we're not a transportation company.
Right.
We're a technology company. And all we're doing is facilitating the transactions. Well, I'm sorry, but if you're facilitating the transactions as a corporation, that's what corporations exist to do. Corporations exist to disperse risk and to provide services. They should be employees.
Yep.
And so you have this situation where people who drive Uber or people who drive Lyft or DoorDash or whatever, and you know this probably from your own personal experience, that oftentimes you're going to be making below minimum wage or you're going to be operating at a loss because you own your car, you have to pay for the insurance, you have to pay for the fuel, you have to pay for the maintenance on the car, and you often are driving around a lot, you know, trying to get a ride. So, and all of this really led in California to Proposition 22, which was the proposition that Uber and Lyft and all these companies really wanted to get done that allowed them to continue business as usual under the existing independent contractors system.
Right.
Instead of you being employees, you're independent contractors, which means that you don't have to follow the same wage, labor, or safety conditions as you would if you were an employee. By the way, just as a quick side note, one of the big people who worked at Uber, who was one of the sort of the people who helped orchestrate the Proposition 22, was a veteran of the Obama White House. I don't think that's surprising to me.
No.
You know, also another person who was a veteran of the Obama White House was one of the chief communications people for Amazon, who said that Chris Smalls, who was trying to organize workers, was not very bright or articulate. And just for you to know, Chris Smalls is a black man. So this is a white man, rich white man, telling a black man that he's inarticulate in emails. So there's that. And So, yeah. So, Corey, I would love to take a minute and could you tell us about your DoorDash experience?
I mean, so I guess more specifically to something that's in the book is like the Uber experience. Like, and so in 2019, Uber came to Regina, the city I live in, and they initially started us off as drivers with a guaranteed $20 an hour, no matter how many trips you got.
Okay.
So for the first, what was it, month and a half, 2 months, you were guaranteed $20 an hour. So you got in the habit, you're working every night as long as you can go. And I mean, they had a limit of 12 hours, I think it was. You're not allowed to be a driver for longer than 12 hours. But then it's pretty fast after that happens that there's too many drivers because there's no limit the way there was for like a cab company, right? Who they limit how many people can drive cab in a city so that everybody gets a decent wage. Uber does not do that. They have no rules about how many people are there. So nobody has enough trips to make enough money to drive. So then you sit in parking lots or you drive around. And like the people are the advice on the app or the chat on the app always says, well, you're probably going to get better trips if you're moving. Right. So a lot of people will drive around and drive around and drive around until they get a ping and then they'll go and pick somebody up. But I used to sit in parking lots. And so then I could at least turn my car off. Because if I'm going to sit there for 45 minutes, I'm not, why am I driving?
Right.
And I mean, eventually it became like a situation where I had to do every single app. Like we have Skip the Dishes here, which is like DoorDash, but it's Canadian. Okay. We have DoorDash. I was doing Uber and I was doing Instacart all at the same time. And then if I was doing one, I would pause the others and then I would go and do that. And like, and that's how you just, so that you can guarantee that you're making a little bit of money every hour. Because sometimes you just, if you're just doing one app, you won't make any money for like 3 hours.
Jesus.
Yeah. Like it's not a good way to live.
and I think you made a really good point earlier about like how you kind of have to drive around, right? Or sometimes you're driving around or you're sitting in a parking lot, right?
Yeah.
The whole thing, what they sold Uber on is this idea that because people will be doing ride shares, there will be less cars on the road.
Yeah. It's going to decrease congestion, right?
It's going to decrease congestion. The problem is whether it's highway planners, Uber, whatever, they do not understand the concept of induced demand.
Right.
They just don't. So what is induced demand, which is something Marx brings up in the book? Induced demand is essentially when you build something, it will then be used more because you built it.
Yeah.
So for example, one of the things you'll often hear is, well, if we just add another lane to this highway, it will loosen up traffic.
Yeah.
Well, because there will be another lane on the highway, more people will drive because there's the possibility of being able to do that. So more people will do it. It's the same thing with Uber. If you have, you know, if anybody can do it, if they don't have a cap on how many people are at any given time, because he talks about in the book about how like cab companies in connections with unions would often have a cap on how many people can be on the road at any given time.
Yep.
That protected wages and it also combated against congestion. Very smart, very reasonable regulations. Uber and Lyft don't fall under those. So anybody can be on the road at any given time.
Sorry. Some random geek said, don't forget that Uber was pitting drivers versus drivers for rides, Ayn Randian competition. And then also said, this is the one that made me laugh. So viewers, give money to Corey Johnson by joining his Patreon so he doesn't have to do Uber ever again.
Yes, absolutely, folks. Absolutely. I'm going to reiterate that. Let's get those Patreon numbers up so he does not have to do this bullshit. It's bullshit.
It is bullshit.
And so, you know, the whole idea that, you know, people are going to buy less cars. There are going to be less cars on the road. There'll be less fuel. There'll be less fuel used. It'll be more environmentally friendly. None of that was true.
Yeah.
None of it was. And the guy who was like the CEO of Uber was pushed out due to sexual harassment. So it's like, so he's an asshole on top of being a bad businessman,
yeah.
Like being bad at Yeah.
The people I felt bad for, like, because over the years I've talked to a lot of other Uber drivers, and there are guys and women and who have bought cars specifically to do Uber because they were retiring and this was going to be their retirement job, or they were, you know, they were doing something else and now this was what they were going to do. And they went out and they bought cars especially for this. And you can't make a living doing it. You can't make your car payments doing it. Like, it's the only way to do it is if you're in your car waiting for rides 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And pretty that's much. No life.
No, it's not. And it's sort of this, and all of these like Silicon Valley fixes, like, oh, these are the things we're going to fix our society with. Right. It's taking something which is explicitly a political issue and making it a non-political issue and making it worse. So like, on principle, like, I am very, very strict about this for the most part. I'm not 100%, but I try to be very strict about this. When I travel, I do not Uber, I do not Lyft, I do not DoorDash, I do not stay in an Airbnb, I do not stay at a Vrbo or whatever those are called. I will stay in a hotel, I will ride in cabs, and I will do mass transit.
Right.
Why am I doing all of those things? Because most of the time in those situations, those are going to be unionized jobs with living wages and regulations.
Yeah.
Not just for safety, but for people to be able to make a living off of it.
Yeah, that's right. Like you say, even if they don't have a union, there are laws that protect them, that where gig workers, Airbnb, like people, Airbnb takes rents off the market, right? But like, hotel workers make minimum wage or above. Cab companies pay their workers a wage that makes sense. Like, these gig companies, they're just exploitation.
Yes, it's all to subvert labor law.
Yeah.
And turn people into what Douglas Copeland would have called micro serfs.
Yeah.
It's a form of techno-feudalism, as somebody has called it. And it's gross. And I try not to have anything to do with it.
If somebody wants to check out like specifically DoorDash stuff, the Full Dash Closure is the podcast to check out over that.
Okay.
It's cool. A very good podcast on that.
So, you know, and the thing is that like, so Uber obviously didn't solve congestion, but what about, so those are the streets, but what about the sidewalks? So there's another chapter in the book where Paris Marx writes about how more and more of the sidewalk is being taken up by people who are not walking.
Mm.
So it's the scooters. This is okay. Just give me like a minute.
Okay.
Or give me like 2 minutes.
Give me a little bit.
I'm going to do a rant for a minute about how much I hate the scooters. hate the electric scooters. I don't hate them in principle. I do not hate them in principle. I hate them in practice.
Yeah.
So a few years ago, they introduced the scooters in Indianapolis. And the problem is it's like Bird, and which I think is owned by either Elon Musk, or it's one of them's owned by Uber. But there was a couple of, one was, I think was called Lime, but there were a couple of different companies that have the scooters. The big problem with the scooters is, again, they're not solving the problem. So like they often do not have a long shelf life. A lot of them get worn out within a matter of months, which again is the same problem with like the electric cars. It's all those heavy metals that have to be mined in order for those electric vehicles to run. So I've seen them, like there's a big canal that's in downtown Indianapolis. I take walks on it during work. I've seen the scooters thrown in the canal. It's awesome. I often take a picture of it. I enjoy it so much.
Yeah.
Anytime I see somebody riding on one of those electric scooters, I want them to go in the canal so bad.
They recently introduced that in Regina here. Yeah. This last summer we got scooters, and I never see anybody using them.
Oh, thank God.
They're sitting there in their rows on the sidewalk, taking up space.
Good. I mean, well, good that no one's using them. Bad that they're taking up space.
Yeah, that's right.
But here in Indianapolis, like you can just sort of pick them up anywhere and drop them off anywhere. So you can see them in the middle of the fucking sidewalk.
Yeah.
And I know they're supposed to be like designated spaces, but they never follow that. So, and I've seen them whipping through like the streets or whatever. It's just, it's another form of congestion.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is, it's like, I'm convinced Silicon Valley hates walking. I think these people hate walking.
Yeah.
Because
I believe it.
Because whether it's Musk and Hyperloop, the scooters, Uber or whatever, why walk when you can Uber? And it's like, you could have easily walked the 10, 20 minutes to walk a couple blocks to go where you were going to, or you could do an Uber. What's better for everyone is just walking. It's good for you because it's going to save you money, and it's going to be good for your health because getting some good steps in helps with the physical health, helps with the mental health. It's good for you all the wrong. We don't create this like gig economy where people are basically slaves to their vehicles. And on top of all of that, you don't have all these extra cars in the fucking road.
Yeah.
It's just stupid. Like, I mean, this is the problem, is it's like the whole move fast and break things ethos of Silicon Valley sucks.
Yeah.
It sucks. You know?
Yeah. No,
it you should move so slowly and not break shit. That should really like
be fucking thoughtful about what you're doing.
Be thoughtful about what you do. Like, be considerate of other people. I know it's really hard for people in Silicon Valley to understand because they're like Ayn Rand heroes who only love themselves. But like, you need it. But that's the thing, is it's like they sell selfishness and narcissism as changing the world.
Yeah,
I think that's the biggest problem I have with Silicon Valley above all else as like a meta concept, is they just sell the ideas of narcissism and mass consumption and necessary consumption as changing the world or being positive.
Yeah.
It's like, no, changing the world requires politics, and you people don't have real politics. So I hate the scooters. Right. I look forward to a time where they all get thrown in a landfill. Like, I can't wait. Or that they're repurposed to make high-speed rail lines. Like, yeah, I just, right. I, you know, like, I hate them. I hate them, hate them, hate them. Because, again, they do not solve the problem.
Some random geek says, there are some folks that are using the scooters in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. I saw them, too, when I was there back in April. I feel like, maybe they're on the wane. That's my hope. I'm just like, why don't you just walk? I don't understand this. Just walk. It doesn't take you that much longer. Those scooters don't get very fast. I've seen them.
It can't be that much more comfortable to be standing on a scooter than it is to just be walking.
You know, and it's like, and I genuinely believe on some level that like Silicon Valley really wants the future that Wall-E had, where people are just like these pods who sit in pods and just consume all day.
Yep.
They do nothing. They contribute nothing. They just sit and consume.
Yep.
And they don't know anybody else, and they don't talk to anybody else. Like, that's the future they want. And that's what Paris Marx talks about in one of the chapters about the sidewalks, where it's like you have like these robot delivery systems, Amazon packages, and how Amazon delivery trucks are really clogging up roads and making it harder for people to use the sidewalks, where even the sidewalk is not safe anymore.
Yep.
And so, you know, so I guess we can pivot into talking about like the long-term vision of what they want and then what we should do. The long-term vision of what they want is kind of what I said, which is that they want to have everyone in a individualized hyper-consumer society, where in order to alleviate our pain, we just buy shit and we stay in our little pod places and we don't think about the consequences of everything around us. That's really what they want, because that's how they're going to make money. And they know that if they can split people up, then people don't have any sense of solidarity. They can't organize.
Right.
They can't realize, oh, this sucks. And part of the reason why I think people hate, why public leaders hate TikTok so much, and we can have criticisms of TikTok and social media in general, but I think one of the reasons they hate TikTok so much is that people get on the app and share their and express their shared frustrations with living under capitalism. And they don't like it, because it's kind of the first time in human history, at least in modern human history, where everybody's kind of in the same platform and they're all sharing their grievances all at once, and people can see it. They don't like that. So that's part of the reason why they're trying to shut it down, and they're using the excuse of China to do it. I think their long-term vision is to create a society that is apolitical and solely focused on hyper-consumption and using greenwashing as a means to sell it.
Yeah.
That if we do these things, we, you know, but it's demonstrable that like electric cars are not going to save us, that Uber is not going to be the future of transportation,
right.
That there are no, like, flying cars are not really going to be a thing.
Self-driving isn't coming anytime soon.
Yeah, we didn't even really get all that much into the self-driving cars chapter, which, long story short, like, self-driving cars are not going to happen, period. Yeah. They're not. So, like, people who are worried about, like, losing their jobs because of self-driving cars, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. They're terrible. Terrible.
Yeah.
Years ago, there was a visual artist who did a performance art piece where he took, like, an electric car, like a self-driving car, and he put a cone in front, and he put two cones in the back. And the electric car couldn't figure out how to get out of the cones.
Right.
So it's just kind of weeble-wobbling around in the cones. Bingo. The other thing, too, is that there have been people killed by self-driving cars. He tells the story of the woman who was the first woman recorded to ever have been killed by a self-driving car, and kind of tells that story. Yeah. So we're recreating the same problems we had with cars 100 years ago. And the technology does not work. And as I mentioned in the pregame, like, the Justice Department is investigating Tesla because they lied consistently about what their self-driving cars could and could not do.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, yeah, like, self-driving cars aren't going to happen. Solar roads are not going to happen. Like, none of it. None of it.
That's right. Solar roads was nonsense.
Roads was total nonsense.
I don't know who thought
total
that was
nonsense.
Real. That's fucking silly.
And that was, like, for me, I was like, how could anybody think this was a real deal? Yeah. But one of the Skeptics Guide to the Universe guys really thought the Solar Roads idea would happen. I'm like, really? Dude, what the fuck? Like, you're a skeptic. You should know this is bullshit. Yeah. Come on. and so, like, these, you cannot tech your way out of a political problem. And I think that's, like, the big takeaway from tonight's episode is, it's like, political problems require political solutions.
Yep.
They require actual politics. You can't just invent or innovate or entrepreneurialize your way out of a problem. It's not how society works.
I think it's worth mentioning that means that you can't just go along with the political parties and electoralism the way it is.
Because I agree too.
There is no real politics in the differences between these parties. It's all
absolutely not.
It's all obfuscation, and it's all fucking meant to alienate you and, like, make you feel outraged so that you won't actually pay attention to, like, and not to be conspiracy theorist about it, but, like, the money is funneling up. The power is up at the top.
Yes.
and you're mad because their school is accepting your kids' pronouns. Like, you're mad at the wrong things. If you're mad at teachers and nurses.
sorry, I didn't mean over.
I
totally agree with you. And I think, like, and we've said this before, and I'm going to say this again, identity politics is a dead end. It's a dead end, folks. It's not going to get us to where we need to go.
Not to say that
caring about your identities are bad. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is the way that bourgeois capitalist politics uses identity politics as a means to obfuscate the class dynamics and the nature of how oppression of specific identities actually happens is not going to be solved merely by participating in said capitalist politics.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's going to require, you know, social movements, and it's going to require massive real changes in public policy to get us to where we need to go. And that's only going to happen through people organizing and changing the system.
Yeah.
Not from the inside, but from the outside.
Some random geek, but you're going to vote for Biden in 2024. If you don't, Trump could win, and then it is your fault.
Oh my God.
He's definitely being sarcastic. I want to make.
Right. It's clearly sarcastic. So I'm definitely not voting for Biden. I'm definitely not voting for Trump. I will more than likely vote for Cornel West in the presidential election, but I will not be voting for Biden. He sucks. And I thought, you know, a few years ago, I thought maybe circumstances would push it to be better, and I was wrong. I think he is nothing more than a warmongering lapdog for empire. And I think that if, you know, I've been very critical of, U.S. involvement in Ukraine, have been very critical of the U.S. involvement in Israel. It just seems like we can always have money to send off to war to kill people, mostly innocent people, including children. But we don't have money to, like, I don't know, have an IRS that works so that people could file their taxes for free instead of having to use a tax service. That's one of the things the House Republicans did, was they cut IRS funding to pay for Israel aid. And so it's, which they said would be, it would be deficit neutral, which is nonsense, because as Robert Reich pointed out, for every dollar that is provided in funding to the IRS, it gets back the American taxpayer $12.
So if you take money out of it, it's never going to be deficit neutral?
Because they can't then go after the people who are actually dodging taxes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But like Mike Johnson, the new Speaker of the House, who's not just a theocrat, but a corporate whore. Like, it's not like it's of course, like, oh, we get to help out our, psychotic religious ethno state, and we can cut funding to a government agency, and we can do something for our rich buddies. Shit, this works for us. Like, it's perfect. I think that at this particular juncture, I highly encourage people to, to get educated. And that's part of what I do is hopefully as an educator and sort of bringing these ideas to light. But the other part of it is organizing, building systems of alternative power, and moving away from expecting capitalist politics to solve your problems, because it's not.
Yeah.
It's just not.
That's right.
Biden sucks, and I cannot believe that, like, the Democratic Party is as absolutely bloodthirsty and warmongering as it is. But it is. So in general, how do we get out of the mess that we're in? There's a huge mess, but specifically in context of the book. So Paris Marx talks about how in the last part of the book, the sort of solutions, the what can we do? And what we really need to do is, obviously, we need to abolish capitalism. That's like the big thing. But like outside of that, what do we need to do? What we really need to do is redesign cities, not around cars, but around people.
Yeah.
That we build cities and communities where high-speed rail is a priority. Where, and Mr. Joe Amtrak riding Biden, you'd think he would give a shit about this, but not really. It would be very easy to, like, have the federal government, like, retrain people who work at car manufacturing plants to be transitioned out of making cars into making high-speed rail, yeah, or to be making buses, electric buses, or be making mass transit. We could bring back the interurban lines. Like, streetcars could be a thing in the United States again,
Yeah.
And that we could redesign cities. Changing zoning laws would be one of the very things that you can do, because so much is determined by zoning laws in the U.S., and I'm assuming it's comparable in Canada.
Yeah.
And, in terms of engaging capitalist politics, like engaging like local and state stuff to change policies specifically is a good way to go. Like, it's something you could really make a difference. But in general, we have to move away from car-centric infrastructure to build the kind of equitable world that we want. That's not just equitable in terms of like providing people with, I would love to live in a world where we had high-speed rail, we had interurban lines, we had good bus lanes, where we had sidewalks on every street, that we had bike lanes on every street, that we, and the other thing too, and this is something he mentions in the book, that subways should be fare free. Anybody should be able to ride them at any time they want for no cost. It should be no cost to them at the point of service.
Yeah.
It should just all be funded publicly by taxes. Yep. And it can be very, very easily done. I'm going to leave you with a quote from the book. So this is towards the end, where he writes, "A more equitable, environmentally conscious transportation system will ultimately require reducing the use of automobiles, regardless of what powers them, and embracing other forms of mobility that not only produce fewer emissions per person, but offer a path to reimagining our communities in a way that does not need to make room for cars." And I agree. I think that the sort of mid-century gamble that the industrial world made on cars was a bad bet. And I think that in order for us to really get to a better climate future, and just a future that people are going to enjoy living in, that like they're going to be happy in, right? I think we get away from having the car be everything. And as I've said multiple times tonight, build the world for people and not for cars.
Yeah, that's right.
Because cars don't care. They don't have feelings because they're just metal boxes. And we need to get over the fetish of owning metal boxes.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I'm going to get any good feeling I have driving a car. I've had that exact same feeling being on a train, being on a subway, and being on a bus. I've pretty much had the same feeling of, oh, I'm going where I want to go. This is great. And so, yeah.
Yeah. You know? And there's a lot of negativity that comes with being in a car driving around with other traffic and being like
traffic.
Yeah.
We didn't even really talk tonight about traffic.
Yeah. There's a lot of negativity there.
If hell is real, hell is a highway during rush hour.
Yeah.
That's like the I'm not a very angry person, but it makes me livid. Because it sucks. Yeah. Yeah. And you just see that it's like one accident or one minor thing can throw off the whole thing and it becomes immensely inefficient. And you're like, this is an insane way to build society, right? Like I'm not alone in thinking this is insane. It is. It's absolutely insane. So we need to get away from cars and we need to get back to thinking about people.
Yep, for sure.
Because people matter and cars don't.
Agreed. All right. What are we covering next time?
Next time, we are doing another sort of spiritual sequel to a previous episode. We're going to be doing the book. I had to look at the title real quick because I always kind of mess it up. But the book is just called Marxism in the United States. It's by Paul Boole.
Okay.
And it's going to be a history of the American left, specifically like within a Marxist perspective. So the episode will be – that discussion will be a great companion to The S Word, which recently came out a few weeks ago. By John Nichols. That book, I think, is good. And I think that this book we're going to be talking about is even better.
Yeah.
And so that is what we'll be doing next time.
Awesome. And I guess, where can people find you?
So you can find me at justinclark.org. That's my website. That's where all my writing and the episodes of the podcast are all there. You can also follow me on social media at Justin Clark PH. PH stands for Public History. I'm on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. I'm trying to use Blue Sky more these days, same with Threads. But I'm mostly on Instagram. I also have a LinkedIn, but I barely use that.
I also have a LinkedIn, but nah.
I'm convinced people who use LinkedIn on like a consistent, regular basis might be a little nuts. But that's okay. Cause I'm a little nuts too. And the other thing I will also mention is I was recently a guest on the Left of the Projector podcast. We had an excellent discussion about the classic 1941 Orson Welles movie, Citizen Kane.
Nice.
We talked all about sort of what really defines history and what is the nature of an empire and the degradations that even the wealthy go through under capitalism, because spoiler alert, even the wealthy are miserable under this system. I know we're not supposed to have a tremendous amount of empathy for them, and I don't, but even they are miserable.
Yeah.
Because you got to know Elon Musk is miserable.
Of course he is. That's why he's constantly seeking validation.
Yes. He's a deeply insecure man who's deeply unhappy because he needs to work out his own shit. But anyway, So that episode will probably come out at some point. I'm not exactly sure when, but I'll make an update about it on my social media. And usually my outside podcast appearances, I also make available on my website too. Cool. So when that comes out, check it out. And as always, Patreon, 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 Patreon. We just talked about how awful Uber is. Make sure that Corey never has to do an Uber trip again. Never again will he have to suffer the indecency of having to do that.
We just got 6 inches of snow today, so I'm not looking forward to going out and doing
exactly. This is how the world is crazy. So you got like 6 inches of snow. It was like 68 here today. It was like 72 yesterday. I mean, it's the weather. I think we're in for either like a very short but brutal winter, or it's going to be like a long, balmy, normal winter. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. But anyway, Patreon, 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 Patreon. Skeptical Leftist on Patreon help out our boy. He's working so hard. And he's putting out these incredible thumbnails for the videos. He's doing this great editing. And
I don't even want to admit how many hours I worked on the thumbnail. It was just,
God. Yeah, like it's because he is the one who makes all this possible. And I can't thank him enough. It's been so much fun, you know, and, you know, I'm already thinking about it because, come next April, we've been doing this 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. And this is certainly the longest project I've ever done like this. So, and I can't thank you enough for being such a great co-host and being such a great friend. And like I said, Patreon. Well, give our guy a follow. Give our guy some money so that he doesn't have to deal with this bullshit. Because I wouldn't want him to deal with it. I've never done it. I've only ridden in Ubers, and I didn't even like that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, patreon.com/ what? Skeptical leftist?
Yeah, it's patreon.com/ skeptical leftist.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, definitely follow him on Patreon. So,
right on. Thanks, everybody, for joining us in the live stream. And thank you, Some Random Geek, for your comments. And
as always, thank you. Thank you, sir. It's been great. And we'll be chatting in 2 weeks. I'll see you then.
You bet. All right. That's all, folks. Thanks for watching or listening. Remember to share this show with your friends and on the social media site that you use the most. Thank you to everyone who supports this show on Patreon. I really appreciate it. And it helps me keep the internet and power on. Thanks to my top patrons, Some Random Geek, Damian Marie at Hope, Justin Clark, Christopher Taylor, Dan F. Smith, and Lisa Glass. And thank you to my new patrons. You can stay tuned for the list of patrons at the end to see your name listed. If you aren't a patron and want to contribute, you can do that at patreon.com/skepticalleftist, or you can send a one-time donation to buymeacoffee.com/skepticallefty. These days, I also have a Substack and a Ghost where you can subscribe for free or you can donate per month. And lastly, you can get a paid subscription on Spotify that will give you the same access to bonus content and extra long episodes. If you can't contribute financially, then a like on YouTube or a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or one of the podcast review sites like Podchaser would be great. If you want to find more from me, then make sure to check out the show notes for links to all my stuff or check out my website, skepticalleftist.com. That's where you can find all of my social media spaces and communities, as well as the other shows that I do. You can also email me at mindofaskepticalleftist@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening or watching. Make sure to leave a comment on the video or on my website. Join your local org, print off some posters or pamphlets, and spread the propaganda. Also, make sure to stick around for a clip from this episode's post-show chat between me and Justin.
Daylight savings time.
It's so dumb.
Here's the thing. It was never a big part of my life until high school. So it was Indiana never ever did daylight savings time until Mitch Daniels became governor in 2005. And that was when it switched. I hate daylight savings time. I hate it. I'd much rather just, and there was murmurings that the US Congress was going to pass like a bill to just like make daylight savings time permanent. And, and we would just do away with it. And like Ted Cruz was like a sponsor. I'm like, it's the only time Ted Cruz and I are ever going to agree on anything. And just for those who need to know, it's not for the farmers.